place, watch me steal the show. Higher ground, yeah, I'm rising fast. This is my moment, it's built to last. Keep the focus.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. I'm your host, Rebecca Whitman, helping you go from burned out and overwhelmed to balanced, beautiful, and abundant. Today, we have a real hero in our midst. Welcome to the show, Martin Williams.
Hello, hello. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Nice to meet you. So glad you're here. I am going to tell my audience about your amazing background. So Martin Williams has led an extraordinary life. He has had 45 years of experience leading extreme expeditions, including climbing Mount Everest, the North and the South Poles, whitewater rafting, and meditation retreats around the world. He has created global leadership projects for 65 million youth to participate. His accompanying primetime documentary was seen on national TV stations around the world. As a professional speaker, he has spoken to audiences of over 100,000 people on 7 continents. Most recently, he spent 7 years as a monk studying and teaching yoga and the enlightenment sciences to thousands of people in India and around the world. Martin is renowned for his bliss, humor, energy, and love of life. Wow, those are all such great things. I have my husband listening in the background and I want him to hear you. So I'm going to give him, can you grab my AirPod, honey, and like hide it so my computer doesn't pick it up, because I want you to hear this interview. It's in my ear.
And I noticed that you speak about bliss quite a bit too, don't you? And you focus on the end, you know, the highest form of life is really living in that blissful space, isn't it? You know? Oh, I lost the sound from you now. So.
It's okay. I do focus on bliss, and I really feel that joy is the evidence of God. And I was just talking to a client yesterday, and I asked her to rate her life in terms of the joy factor. Like, what was she doing on a daily basis that was or was not bringing her joy? And life is just too short not to have joy. I'm not saying everything's going to be joyous. Like, you do have to do like taking out the garbage and, you know, cleaning the house and stuff like that. But to find the joy in everything. So I would love to hear your story, your origin story. You're from England. Where did you grow up and how did you get into, you were one of the pioneers. Now there's a whole culture of outdoor action and adrenaline junkies and people climbing every mountain in the world. But you were one of the first people to do that. How did you go from growing up in England to getting into these kind of exciting adventures and ultimately finding your spiritual enlightenment on these very arduous journeys?
Ah, what a great question. So,
multiple questions.
Yeah, that's right. Multi layers to that question. So, yeah, I grew up in Liverpool, England, and I was the youngest of 3 brothers.
Did you see the Beatles perform before they were famous?
No, but I went to the cavern where they played at my lunchtime. The Beatles played in the evening, and it was like 18 cents to get in. I went at lunchtime for 9 cents and saw groups like the Holly, groups that became part of the Merseyside wave that became successful around the world. So
nice.
So I just missed, but my brothers actually played, one brother played rugby with 2 of the Beatles.
Nice, because you're just a couple years younger than them. So I think that you'd be contemporaries, and I know Liverpool is not so big. So, go ahead.
So youngest of 3 brothers, and my family would go walking every Sunday in Wales, which is just, you know, close to Liverpool, mountainous area. So I guess from an early age, I was exposed to nature. And then I really see it as a natural curiosity to wonder what's around the next bend. So do this following, like, what's over the next hill, what's around the next bend, then started leading me into, by 14, I was rock climbing. by 16, I was starting to do little expeditions. Then I went to climbed in the Alps, and so one story here is that at age 16 in the Alps, I saw mountain guides and said to my dad, "You know, Dad, I would love to become a mountain guide." And my dad said, "Well, we're from Liverpool, you know, it's not possible. Mountain guides are taught by their fathers. It's a passed on from father to son, so it's impossible." But I had this idea that I could become a mountain guide. So fast forward 5 years later, I'm in Northern Canada, and I get a call saying, "Would I guide on these mountains in Canada?" So I know you follow the same theme of just when we have a vision, often there's a it's not a straight line to the result, but when we have a vision and hang on to it, often a circuitous path unfolds that takes us from the vision to the reality. And so it's about creating the vision and hanging on to it and falling into that space. There's a space around the vision, right, which then manifests it further down the road, sometimes super fast, sometimes longer. Right?
So you started giving people guides up and down the Alps? You hiked in the Alps and then you started guiding people in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
How did that lead to these very dangerous expeditions? Because I know people have died, you know, walking to the North and the South Pole and Antarctica and climbing Mount Everest. So where did this quest for danger come?
I guess the danger, I don't think the quest was for danger. I think the quest was discovery. And danger is part of the equation. So it's really about, and if you look further down my life, what you see is that this quest was also a quest around human performance. What is possible, you know?
Yes.
So in some ways, the what is possible question was, what is possible to get to the South Pole? How are we going to pull all the logistics? How are we going to the team psychology? What resources do we need? Where do we get the money from? The game, you know, it's like an entrepreneurial game, right? The game of entrepreneurship.
Because I was listening to this John Maxwell audiobook. I forget the name. You might know it. He said, this guy led a team to the North Pole and he wasn't a good leader, so everybody died. Mm-hmm. Because of his leadership. And then another team was guided to the North Pole by another type of leader and everybody succeeded. So I don't know if you know the expedition I'm talking about where everybody died trying to get to the North Pole. Are you familiar with it?
Yes. Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. Yes. It's like
who is this? What was it?
Actually, it would be the South Pole. It would be Robert Scott, a British explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And the team of five died, they got to the South Pole, but then on their return, they ran out of food and all that sort of stuff. And so, meanwhile, the Norwegian explorer took a very different approach, you know? And so, but I really look at it, this is, you know, aspects of the servant leader aspect of it as well, isn't it? It's about knowing your team, working with everybody on the team. And one of the fundamentals I've discovered in team leadership is that we think certain people are the strong members, but it can flip very easily from strongest to weakest. So, for instance, even on a basic hiking trip, you have the 19 or 20-year-old male who's built like an ox and works out all the time, and he's carrying the big load. But then on day three, he gets a blister, can only hobble along, and now you have the 50-year-old lady who is carrying his extra load. But, you know, so we never know when in a team, what skills emerge and what or physical attributes that are needed. So, for instance, other times it can be, you know, often the empathy in a key situation is what's needed, right? And so,
yes,
a person will come out with an amazing amount of empathy and it'll change the whole situation, you know. So, in other times, it'll be, you know, a dynamism that's needed, you know, and somebody else will have that quality. So the team is made up of multiple qualities, and it's how to harness the different qualities, you know?
Well, that's what I think a good leader does, is you meet people where they are, and then you encourage them to just go out of their comfort zone. And obviously, if anybody has signed up to go on an expedition with you, they're wanting to get out of their comfort zone and grow. And like you said about high performance sports, you know, that's a big movement. And people do hiking mountains and endurance running and all kinds of crazy things. I guess there's a spirituality to it. Did you see the movie 14 Peaks?
Yes. Yeah. That's really good. Right?
I'm sure you identify with, he almost died so many times in that movie, like literally in a straight fall. I'm sure there's been times where you've come very close to meeting your maker on one of your expeditions. Why don't you tell us about one time where you thought that was going to be your end?
I've counted it up, and it's been about 14 or 15 times.
Ooh, you're more than a cat. You have more than 9 lives.
Yeah. So what would be there's a bunch of them. So I'm looking for one that has a bit of a
lesson.
Yeah, lesson. That's right. Yeah. So a bunch of the times it's been, so one particular story was skiing. We've climbed a peak. We're coming back down. We're skiing underneath this other gorgeous, gorgeous peak. And it's glistening in the sun, and it's very, very beautiful. And then we look up and we hear a little noise, and we see this little avalanche starting at the top. We say, oh, isn't that beautiful? So we pull out our cameras, we start photographing it, and then the thing triggers, and all of a sudden the whole face is falling down, right? And we're all roped up, and we have sleds. We're pulling pulling about 100 pounds on a sled. So we can't deviate off course. So literally, we try to move, but we can't move. So, and then this huge wind comes down. We get enveloped in a snowstorm. We're all hunkered down. And
are you like sucking each other and staying close to the ground so the snowstorm doesn't take you guys down the mountain? Or
no, actually, we're all roped together. We're spread out to avoid falling into crevasses. So. So we're each on our own, you know, and so there I am hunkered down, and the wind is howling, and the snow is, it's just like, just a wild being, you know, being in a hurricane type thing. And then everything dies down, and this wall of snow has stopped like 30 feet away from us. And the wall is like 20 feet high, and if it had come that little more, we wouldn't be around. So we just skedaddled out of there really fast.
And you still wanted to go on more expeditions after that, even though you almost got swallowed up by an avalanche.
Yeah, I guess, you know, once you, coming back, some other people have described it as like, there's a rat that you come back and you forget about the dangers, and then the rat of curiosity starts nibbling again. So you have to go. Some people call feeding the rat.
And actually, it's called a bug. You get bitten by the bug, and then once you get bitten by the acting bug, you just have to do it, no matter what the sacrifice. So I guess in action adventure, it's called the rat. So what, did you ever lose any of your clients on any of your expeditions? Did anybody die?
No. I've been super, super good that way. You know, I'm really
very lucky. Mm-hmm. Did anybody come close?
A few times. One time, we'd climbed a peak and we were coming back down. We were skiing down, and I'd instructed everybody, I go first, ski up to me and stop by me because I'm not sure what's ahead. And so one of the people didn't pay any attention to that, skied past me, went into a crevasse, so we had to pull them out of the crevasse. They were safe. They were down 50 feet, but we managed to get them out.
So they did a fifth drop down 50 feet?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, so let's go back to your life story. So you're in Canada, you're doing guiding there, and then where did you go from Canada?
So what happened there is that a friend of mine who I'd climbed with a lot came to me and said, I want to climb the highest peaks in each continent, At that point, it hadn't been done. So the seven continents, seven summits. Now it's a very big deal, and there's a few hundred people have done it. But he wanted to be the first to do it.
And so you guys were the first, you and your friend?
My friend was the first, yeah.
What's his name?
Pat Morrow.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive, still out hiking in the hills and enjoying life.
So you were the second person or to do the seven?
No, so I helped him on all these peaks. So, okay. Yeah. So because running my guiding business, I wanted to run the business rather than focus on doing these seven summits, you know, so it wasn't a priority for me.
And what are the seven summits?
So, okay. So in North America, it's Mount McKinley, Aconcagua in South America, Mount Everest in Asia, a peak called Karstens Pyramid in Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia. In Europe, it's Erebus. And then in Antarctica, it's Mount Vinson.
Whoa. So you helped your friend make
his... So the hardest peak to get to was the Antarctic peak. And it took us, again, it's that whole idea of a vision turning into reality. So we had the vision. We had, you know, basically not very much money. But over 3 years, we found people who would finance it. We then discovered we needed aircraft. And so we found there was one plane in the world that could fly the distance. So we found the one plane in the world. We found investors who would come in who wanted to climb the peak. So we put all this project together over 3 years and finally got to the mountain and climbed it, you know?
So you had to fly to the base of the mountain. It wasn't accessible.
That's right, yes. It was 2,000 miles away from the nearest town, you know? And it was like a week-long journey by flight. So we'd arrange fuel caches. So even when we got to the mountain, we didn't have enough fuel to get back out. We had to have an airdrop at the mountain of fuel to fuel the plane up so we could get back out.
Oh my God, that sounds very intense. And you were the first person to scale that mountain to climb Antarctica, or?
Well, yeah, there've been a few people there before, so we were the first to ski from the summit of the mountain.
So you do most of your expeditions on skis.
A lot of it, yeah.
Interesting. Wow. So have you gotten into the whole snowboarding trend?
Yeah, I snowboard as well. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Okay, so your friend says, I need your help scaling these seven summits. You guys achieve that. And then
having come back from this climbing Mount Vinson, the phone started to ring off the hook saying, hey, we want to go and climb the mountain. So we formed a company to then guide other people. And then from the top of Mount Vinson, again, the whole idea of what's next, we looked over and there was the South Pole 730 miles away, right?
Hold that thought. We are going to cut to a quick commercial break. When we come back, we are going to talk to Martin Williams about climbing the South Pole. You are watching the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show with Rebecca Whitman, and we're so glad you're here. See you in a minute. Welcome back, everyone. We are talking to Martin Williams, world explorer, first man to walk across Antarctica. So, Martin, okay, so you're standing on top of which mountain when you noticed that there was the South Pole Mountain?
The highest peak in Antarctica, which is Mount Vinson. Mm-hmm. And at the summit, we realized, oh, the South Pole is over there. 700.
You can see it.
No, we can't see it, but we know it's over there.
Right? It's that way.
Yes.
Okay.
And we realized that it had been only visited overland the expedition we mentioned at the beginning with Scott, who died, five people died, right, on that expedition, then the Norwegians.
And when was the expedition where five people died going to the South?
That was in like 1914, 1912. So it's okay. Way back in history, you know, but it's, yeah. If you, from the perspective of historical exploration, it's one of the big challenges that we face of can we reach the South Pole, you know? Hmm. So then we realized, oh, wow, it's over there. We know the technology. And so let's see if we can put a group together. So we ended up pulling a group of people together, and it took us 50 days to, you know, to ski to the South Pole, you know? And then after that, one of the people on that trip came to me and said, now, nobody's ever crossed Antarctica. Could we go back and then continue on the journey? So then, again, in that whole spirit of exploration, what's possible, you know, I pulled out my maps and I phoned friends up and did all the research. Yes, you know, yes, we could attempt it. So then we went back and ended up traveling from the South Pole out across the continent, you know?
So when you're assembling a team, and I want to relate this to business, because there's a lot of business people listening to this that are building teams, what are some of the qualities that you're looking for when you're assembling one of these teams to go on these very intense expeditions?
Great question. So what I see is that, so another project that I did, I'll give you maybe it's even a better example. I realized that nobody had ever gone from the North Pole to the South Pole under human power. And it's like 25,000 miles, right?
And you did so that?
We did that as well, yes.
On skis?
No, on skis, bicycle, canoe, kayak, sailboat.
So you did everything. Everything to go from the North to the South Pole. You basically crossed the entire globe.
Yeah, through North and South America. The route we took was, yeah.
But whoa, okay, we're going to get into that expedition in a minute, but what do you look for in team members?
So what for that project, I was choosing 8 young people from around the world who were going to do the journey as a message to other young people about the power of human potential, right? So when I brought these people together, these 8 young people, age 18 to 25, I thought, how do I need to train them? I have 6 weeks to train them for this journey. What's the essential skill? Which is basically your question, right? So what I did, I put them through as many situations as I could to give them a vast variety of experience handling new situations. So that so I came across with every permutation of difficult situation I could think of and put them in. So the essence of it is that the ability to handle a new situation with ease.
That's what it takes to be successful in business and on an expedition, because every day life will throw new situations with us.
That's right. Yes.
So yes. How many people did you pick for this expedition where you said they were age 18 to 80 or?
No, 18 to 25.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Now you're almost 80. You're the only one that can do these expeditions at this age. You're yeah. an anomaly for your age. Yeah. So, okay, so 18 to 25.
And I chose them from various countries.
How did you test them?
So what I wanted, they were from different countries. So I wanted to represent the world. So I had one Korean, one Japanese, one from South America, from Argentina, one from Colombia, one US, one Canada, one French. And so I brought them together, and then we did this training, basically focused on, you know, how to handle, you know, new situations all the time. And then we set up on the journey. But coming back to business, I just want to make the difference there. That's an ideal composition for a team with a small startup, you know, where you want people to be super nimble, right, to be able to face. And it's a quality you need in every team, but also as the team gets bigger, you also need people who are specialists in various things, and you need to, you know, understand their specialty and optimize their specialty.
So when you speak to corporations, I assume you've done a lot of keynotes and a lot of speaking to corporations. What are some of the topics that you address?
Well, precisely that of just how to be. I really look at it, one way to look at it is that, you know, work is 40% of our life. Mm-hmm. And so if we want to live a joyful life, we need to have work that we enjoy. And often it's a reframe, just as you mentioned at the beginning of the show about some things we do in the day can be, you know, as in taking out the trash, right? Mm-hmm. So we can take out the trash frustratingly, or we can take out the trash joyfully, and we can dance the trash out, right? as an example. So in any given situation, we can be in suffering about it, or we can be in various forms of joy, appreciation, in the moment, surrender, empathy, you know, a whole bunch of qualities, right? And so it's how do we, and this is why I enjoy your show so much, because this is what you're emphasizing, right? This is my perception of what you're emphasizing on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, okay. So we have these choices, and it's how do we move from unconscious patterns to making much more conscious choices about our thought patterns, our behavior patterns, you know?
Well, you must thank you for addressing that. You must have a very different relationship with pain than most people, because I'm sure you and a lot of your team members, when you're walking like 25,000 miles from the south to the North Pole, you have injuries. You know, you pull a hamstring, you have a blister, your knee, you know, goes out, your back hurts. So what is your relationship like with pain?
So it's a good question. And for sure, I do have a higher tolerance of pain. And also, what I see is that pain, we have pain, and then what's different is suffering, right? And that is when we complain about the pain, when we gripe about the pain, which actually often over exaggerates the pain, you know. So we have the phenomenon of pain in the physical body, which is nerve endings yelling, right? And then we have the psychological aspect of it, which is you know, how to approach the psychology of the pain, and how to be at ease with the mental chatter around it.
And I like the quote, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Mm-hmm. So when your mind starts to have a negative narrative around pain, what are some of the ways that you have found to flip the narrative so you can keep focusing on your destination and not get immersed in the pain?
I think the first of it's identifying the chatter. So often the chatter is either, whether it's external or internal, it's unconscious. So we're saying to a friend, you know, this really sucks, all that sort of stuff. Or we're chattering to ourselves inside saying, you know, so I'll give you an example from an expedition. We're skiing 8 hours a day into you know, a 10-mile or 15-mile headwind, and the temperature's minus 30, right? And
where so, was that?
That's going to the South Pole. That's what a typical day is.
That's what it takes.
Yes.
So you're basically like skiing in a wind tunnel.
Yeah, with your thoughts. That's right. And so, so then it becomes very obvious. As soon as my thoughts would go into complaint, why am I here? What the heck am I doing here? I would slow down. I could notice it in my physical performance. So my complaints weaken me, and I can also daydream. You know, I wish, you know, or not, you know, I remember being back in whatever, or I can just be present with. And if I look around me, actually, the snow crystals and the light is just beautiful, right? So when I'm present with what is, I have good performance. When I go into complaint, I drop performance. When I go into daydreaming, my performance is okay. So, but then coming back to.
So appreciation is a way higher vibration than complaint. So if you can take your mind off your physical injury and look around the beauty of nature and find something to appreciate, that improves your performance.
That's right, yes. And the beauty of nature is easy because it is beautiful, but also we can be in, and I have been, you know, in a hospital situation. I was in India. I had necrotizing fasciitis on my leg and was told I had, you know, 12 hours to live. So
what?
I was in the hospital.
What was that?
This was in, like, 2000 and 2010, 2011, something like that.
So you were told you had 12 hours left to live. And so how did you reframe that narrative to live to tell this story on the podcast so many years later?
So I knew I was being treated, right? And so, you know, they were going to do emergency surgery too. And so there was that aspect too. But also I just saw around me, you know, the nurses being super diligent, the equipment. I was just, I applied appreciation to the situation. And so appreciation, you know, we can access appreciation. It doesn't have to be only the sunset. we can expand our boundaries of appreciation to, hey, even take out the garbage. I do have a garbage can outside,
Anything. I mean, if you're alive and on the planet and above ground, you can find something to appreciate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So literally, appreciation saved your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to have like your foot cut off from frostbite or something?
No, they were able to, it was in my lower leg. So they were able to pack my leg with, to remove all the sepsis, all the poison, all the, the bad bacteria that was in there,
Oh my goodness.
So the danger was that would spread through my whole body. And then it's fairly fast, one goes fairly fast.
Yes. So let's go back to your life story. So you decided to go from the South to the North Pole, 25,000 miles with this group of how many people?
That was eight young people.
Eight young people. And how old were you?
I was in my, 46, something like that. Yeah.
And everybody made it.
Yeah. And there was some, we had some epics along the way. And some misadventures. But again, from the perspective of what I know you're interested in, one of the things that came up, I guess one of my big learnings from that, well, first of all, is the preparation did work. People got really good at handling new situations. So for instance, arriving at a border crossing in South America, and the guards are all of a sudden very grumpy and demanding, and the team was like, yeah, we don't need to freak out. Let's take a breath. Let's just listen carefully. So here having, 20-year-olds handling these situations super well, because of that ability. But then one of the things I did see though is that as the journey became not just difficult but also boring. So now we're bicycling. We've been to, we've had these big highlights, and high adventures, adrenaline, and now we're traveling from New York to Los Angeles across the country, and we're bicycling day after day, right?
That's just that.
Yeah, and the team energy is going down.
I just made that drive with my husband. Just drove from LA to Cincinnati, Ohio, so it is a very monotonous landscape. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. So the team energy is going down. So I'm wondering what to do about this. And a friend of mine suggests a process, and I think you'll find this process pretty interesting. So what the process was that everybody's going to pair up, and you're going to tell your partner who you're sitting with what you don't like about them.
That's a tough mental exercise. That definitely will get the excitement and adrenaline going. Okay.
And the other person is just to respond with a neutral, is not to justify anything like that, is just to be a mirror, right? Mm-hmm. And so they do that, and then next the other person does the same, and then after that, what do I appreciate? So I'll give you a couple of stories. So one of the team members, Dylan, he was told, particularly by the female members, Dylan, you're a slob. You leave your socks, your smelly socks, you leave them everywhere. You're horrible at the dishes. Your cooking sucks. You leave your clothes all over the place. You don't wash it often enough. All these things, right? And so, but then when it came to the positives, that everybody was saying, your level of empathy is super high. Your leadership is good, and so. what I saw is that the team energy had been depressed by all these unconscious grumblings that we have about each other. And so, you know, he's leaving his socks, he doesn't, you know, all that sort of stuff reduces the frequency, basically. If you look at it from a frequency angle, all those unsaid or said complaints reduce the frequency. Yeah. When all of a sudden we stop and look at appreciation, the level, the things we appreciated the person for were huge. And each one of those was, you know, was mountainous, whereas these others were slivers. So the team performance shot off to a new level.
We're going to hold that thought. We're going to go to a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Rebecca Whitman on the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. And Martin Williams, world-class expeditioner, is going to be coming back in just a minute. Thank you so much for being with us. Okay, so you are with this team, and then what happened? What was next after this major? Because I know you, we also, you know, we only have 15 minutes left of the show, and I want to hit all your highlights because you've had such a great life. I want to get to India, where you learned and taught meditation and all the other things. So what happened after you did the trip from the South to the North Pole?
So then I was thinking, what's next, you know? And I'd worked on some of the of the best personal development courses in the USA and North America. And
Which ones did you take? Landmark Forum.
I'd worked with Harv Eker. Do you know Harv Eker at all? Millionaire Mind, things like that. Yeah. So I've been an instructor on courses like that. You know.
And great.
So what I was looking at what is high performance. You know, so now I've worked with a whole variety of people. I've hung out with the Inuit in northern Canada and with the Tibetans and I'd seen so much. And so that's when I started looking at what is our ultimate performance. So then I spent some time with some Buddhist monks and saw that the similarity between.
Now, where did you go to the monastery?
That was in India.
Oh, okay. Before we get there, since you are teaching high performance and my audience loves being a high performer, what are some points that high performers all do?
So there's a vision aspect of it, for sure.
Yes, have your vision.
Mm-hmm. And literally I've seen where the strong visualizations and putting energy into refining visualizations has a massive effect. And people are not capitalizing on that enough.
What is your technique for visualization?
It's really seeing the end result and feeling the energy in the body.
Mm.
And so, and I can give you an example of that. Because here you are, you're probably thinking I'm fearless, but actually I have fear, and the fear is tied with public presentations, things like that. So I'm trying to raise money. I have a phone in front of me. I have the phone number for a friend has given me the phone number for the president of CNN. This person has told me this person would be open to your project, right? But I look at the phone, fear comes over me, my hands sweat, you know, my armpits, my heart's beating, blah, 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 right? And then I would go and plan logistics, which I'm comfortable doing, right? So I'd go and plan what clothing are we going to wear, right? And research clothing. And I realized that unless I pick up the phone, this project is dead. You know, this project won't go anywhere. So I'm going to have to face the fear. So how to face it? So I think, what would I do? Okay, let me visualize the end result. Okay, so in this case, it was the team going to the South Pole. So I'm visualizing these 8 young people at the South Pole, and they're all excited. As I close my eyes, the visualization is so strong, my body chemistry changes. My body chemistry now is joyous, right? So then I reach out, grab the phone, make the call. But then next day, same thing, I'm back into fear again. So again, I realize, oh, wow, I can change my body chemistry very rapidly, even in 30 seconds, if I have a strong visualization. So,
interesting that you for the exercise, like I said, a lot of entrepreneurs, this man is he has less fear climbing, you know, thousands of feet in a snowstorm than picking up a cell phone sometimes. So if you have fear of making these calls, these sales calls or
asking people to look at your product, service, or business, and that is totally normal. So you can do exactly what Martin is saying and visualize them saying yes to whatever it is that you're selling, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Super. So anyway, you were asking about, you know, the sort of the spiritual journey aspect.
Yeah. So let's talk your spiritual journey. How old were you and what made you decide to join a monastery in India?
So I was now in my early 60s. Mm-hmm. And I was still looking at, you know, what is human performance, right? And so then I came across various yogic practices that really intrigued me. So I decided to go off and spend time in this monastery. And what I saw there is that my draw there was that I really saw that I'm trying to turn it into, not use the word enlightenment so much, but use terms that people can understand. So really I see that in terms of emotional resilience or emotional intelligence, there's a line of emotional intelligence, of low emotional resilience, ever increasing emotional resilience, higher and higher and higher emotional resilience, till we become at ease with all, right? Basically. And imagine being in the snow. So specifically in the climbing world would be at ease in the snowstorm, but mad in the office, right?
Yes.
How do you take that ease in the snowstorm and bring it into the office? How do you take the ease of being on a phone call and move it into the mountains, right?
So, exactly.
And so really that's what the journey was in India. So we did things like we'd get up super early in the morning and we'd make a circle in the sand, a 5-foot diameter circle. We'd put logs in it, light the logs on fire, then go and meditate in the middle of this fire, right? And sometimes the clothing would catch fire. And so what would happen there, it was almost like the same as trekking to the South Pole. You know, we've got a few hours and the mind can do all sorts of bizarre things. So 1 minute the mind would be saying, what the heck are you doing here? You know, this is totally stupid.
When your clothes catches fire, you're allowed to stop meditating and throw water on it, right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. I was going to say, I don't want you to be so detached that you're like, oh, I'm actually burning, but I'm just staying connected to God. Like, okay.
That's right.
But you just... I've heard an analogy, you know, your thoughts are kind of like when you're meditating, they're just like embers and you just flick them off and you keep, you know, focusing. So what did you learn as far as meditation technique or practice at the monastery in India?
So fundamentally what I learned is that, you know, there's a space that is blissful where we can handle just about everything in life with ease, and that space is accessible with practice. And then the specific practices, you know, there's so many different forms of meditation. But from I'm super practical, right? And so really, I look at elements of breathing, just a very basic. If you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling anxious, change a breathing pattern, it'll change how you think. You know, so super basic stuff like that. And then other meditations, one of my favorite meditations is sound, just using the sound of the letter M, like that. And I find that when we do that as a quite loudly, it then creates a frequency that dominates the mind. So we can't think over it. So it's a way of like reducing thoughts. So then after a few minutes of humming, we'll find we're in a very different space. We find we're just so different. And then another example would be aspects of, this is where I see tying into everyday life where people go running and things like that. Often they're unconsciously shifting into a meditative space in their activities, you know? And so... in the monastery, we would do things like chaotic breathing, you know, where, and catharsis type stuff, where You could be, you know, one exercise we'd do is we'd be actually, which you can do at home if you go in the bathroom, get in the shower, if there's nobody around, turn the shower on, play some music, loud volume, and then just start releasing and speaking out emotions. But try not to attach meaning to the emotion. It'd be frustration, or just a word that releases the sound, and then just sit in, then just stop and be in silence, and you can find your most, go into the most profound silences.
So how long do you meditate for now?
I'm typically meditating only 20 minutes a day, but I'm my inner space.
That's a lot. I only do 5 minutes a day.
Most days. Okay.
20 is good.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But also I find that our life experience is like a t-shirt. And so here we have the dog bite as a child, the insult from the parents, or the insults from our friend, and they're all spotted over our t-shirt. And meditation is like taking the t-shirt and dipping it slightly in bleach, a light, very light. Each time we meditate, it comes out slightly clearer. So those memories, those impressions are losing their power over us.
That is so beautiful. I love that analogy with the t-shirt. That I'm definitely going to think about that a lot. So you are 76. What does your daily exercise look like today?
So I have a bit of a routine ritual in the morning. So when I wake up, I'm very deliberate about just connecting with bliss, actually. Just bringing a big smile to my face. I normally move my body while I'm smiling. It varies, but often I'm setting an affirmation for the day as well. And then typically I'm doing exercise, even though I've done structured exercise, I much prefer to look at it as movement, and I'm heading out the door, and often I'm going, in the hills right next to me are some scrambling routes I can go up where I'm stepping over things, I'm using my arms and legs. So I'm getting this natural stretching and some cardio. And then often I'm ending the day.
How long do you hike for?
Often an hour and a half, something like that.
Okay. And do you have, are your days of climbing huge mountains over because you're 76? Are you retired from that? Or are you still have it in your heart to do those huge climbs again?
No, I'm still, I was in Nepal in December, doing like a 17-day trip, but not on a big mountain. But so I have some mountains in my sight, and I'm looking at them just, just exploring what's possible still,
Amazing.
I don't feel strong. I feel now that getting out in nature or just movement in nature is hugely soothing for me, hugely calming for me. So I find it
beautiful. And what is your diet like? What do you eat?
I'm vegetarian. So I do enjoy coffee. And I've looked at, obviously at this age, I'm also studying longevity. And so I'm looking at, the latest longevity talks. And so, but I feel like my diet's, I feel like my diet's pretty good.
Your diet's very clean.
Organic. Whole foods as much as possible.
Do you cook or make smoothies, salads, soups? Like, how are you eating vegetarian?
Yeah, so I'm. I do all the cooking in the house, and we eat lots of stir fry type veggies or salad type things. Beans and peas and rice and various veggies,
Great. And you remind me a lot of Wim Hof. Have you ever met him?
No, I haven't, but I've seen his stuff and I really I really like his stuff, you know? And in fact, you know, some of the breathing techniques he uses, we were doing very similar things, or I've done very similar things in India, you know, with these other yogis. So, yeah.
Well, to face, you know, the extreme temperatures on top of mountains and the snowstorms, and I think it's, you really have to have a close relationship with whatever you call it, spirit, source, God, the universe. So let's end the podcast with this question. How do you define God? What is God to you? Is it nature? Is it, what is it? Oneness? How would you define it?
I think oneness is a space of oneness within oneself. So within oneself, when one feels connected with everything and in appreciation, then that's God from my perspective.
Beautiful. And how can people stay in touch with you and learn more about what you do? And I don't know if you're still taking people on expeditions, but I'm sure they're going to want to follow your journey after hearing this podcast.
Yeah. So I have a website, enlighteningadventures.com, and you can go there, find out about me, and then also on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn too, so Martin Williams on LinkedIn as well.
And that's Martin with a Y, MARTYN Williams.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Martin, for being my guest and being a fan of the show, and thank you, listeners, for spreading the message of this podcast. Please share this episode with a friend. Tell people about the show, because you can be high achieving without the burnout. You can be balanced, beautiful, and abundant. And until we meet again, keep your vibe high and magnetized. Bye, everyone.